I know who you are. I know what you think you're doing.
You don't want to get hurt. Keep your mouth shut and don't move a fucking muscle.
The chimps are infected. They're highly contagious. They've been given an inhibitor.
Infected with what?
In order to cure, you must first understand.
Infected with what?
Rage.
What the fuck is talking about?
Time for this. Get the cages open.
No!
Listen, you sick bastard. We're going and we're taking your torture victims with us.
We're going to get you out of here.
Listen, the animals are contagious. The infection is in their blood and saliva. One bite! Stop! Stop! You have no idea!
Hello and welcome to episode 35 of the Z-Realm podcast. And what you just listened to was this awesome introduction that Mushroom Mike had put together for us. And we liked it so much we wanted to let the whole thing play out. It's maybe a little long and we may end up cutting it, using it different ways. But we wanted the first time we played it, we wanted you guys to hear it all the way through. And it's just really great. And we wanted to send out a big thank you to Mushroom Mike for taking the time to do that for us. But having said that, I will introduce ourselves. I'm Marty, and I'm here in my home in Greensboro, and I am joined by...
I'm Olga, and I'm here in my home in Brooklyn, New York.
And I'm KMO, and I'm in that same home in Brooklyn, New York, but since we're doing this by cell phone and there's a delay, I'm in a different room.
Aw, I miss
It's you. Still not quite Tennessee away, though.
No.
We had something that's been on our radar for a long time to talk about and to watch and to get ourselves all sunk up into, and it was the two films that started with 28 Days Later and the second 28 Weeks Later, and a third one I understand is on the way. But this is sort of a landmark zombie film series, and it really started a new trend in zombie films. I mean, I guess they don't even call them zombies, really. They call them the infected. But it's definitely been something we've been meaning to talk about.
Definitely. I mean, these are important films in the zombie genre, but Olga and I just finished watching 28 Weeks Later just a few minutes ago. So it's really, really fresh in my mind. And not only are they important films in the zombie genre, in that they establish some sort of new guidelines by which zombie films are judged. They're just really compelling films. I was moved. And the first one, you know, directed by Danny Boyle, it was starting to fade a bit in my memory, so I watched it for the first time in a couple of years just recently, and there's just some iconic imagery in that film, and it is so well photographed and so well put together. Mm. And, you know, years ago, I watched the DVD extra footage, and so they had so many really stupid ideas for that film. And it's amazing that in, you know, in the final edit and the final process of just putting it all together, they kept everything that was really cool, and they jettisoned just some of the really stupid ideas.
Do you remember some of the stupid ideas?
The king stupid idea was this. They somehow determine that a full body blood transfusion will cure the infected, and so Jim sacrifices himself and gives all of his blood to bring back Hannah's father. What was his name? Frank.
Right.
Yeah. That was the dumbest of the dumb ideas, but there were others.
Wow, it's kind of like Omega Man, where they find out Charlton Heston's blood will cure. You know, it's like an inoculation against the disease. You know, and then at the end, they like it's almost like that. It just continues that sort of Christ theme from Omega Man, and you know,
Omega Man. Go ahead, Olga.
No, I was just gonna make a joke about Charles Heston's blood.
Well, especially here, Omega Man,
for those who don't know, is important in the zombie genre. It is the second film adaptation of I Am Legend.
Right.
And George Romero was. He was strongly influenced by I Am Legend when he was creating Night of the Living Dead.
There's a sequel to I Am Legend on the way.
Really?
I've heard that there is, yeah.
A sequel to the book or a sequel to the
Will Smith
movie? Okay.
The Will Smith movie, yeah.
Right on.
Apparently it made some money, so they said, let's have some more of that.
Yeah, but Will Smith died in that film. Is it a prequel?
What it might be, maybe Jim will come along and give him a transfusion. Or Charlton Heston will.
Or Keith Richards, because, you know.
Shit, that would
really
do it.
Experienced with transfusions.
Now, that would be a great zombie movie, where Keith Richards is the only cure. That would be awesome. Just see him up there wailing, you know, brown sugar up on top of a bus, calling people to him, come, get my blood. That would be awesome.
Yeah, I could see a whole franchise.
Or it turns out that Keith has been a zombie since like 1974.
That explains a lot.
Man walks into a bar with a giraffe. They just get pissed. The giraffe falls over. The man goes to leave, and Barman says, "Oi, you can't leave that lion there." He says, "No, it's not a lion. It's a giraffe."
It's completely humorless. You two should get on like a house on fire.
I love how 28 Days Later opens. It was very reminiscent of the way they handled The Walking Dead when Rick woke up. You know, there's just this empty hospital and what's going on, and you know, but in 28 Days Later, it was just so much more epic because it was the entire city of London.
And both 28 Days Later and The Walking Dead are basically riffing on Day of the Triffids, because Day of the Triffids opens with the main character waking up in a hospital bed after the apocalyptic events have destroyed society, basically.
Oh, wow. I need to watch that. Yeah, that's cool.
Right. And, of course, I'm kind of thinking, as a city dweller with lots of film crews happening here all the time, I'm thinking, wow, how the hell did they get Piccadilly Circus empty like that? I mean, there are no people, no cars. How did they do that? And KML said it's post-production.
Some of that is.
I mean, they would clear streets, obviously, but there were sweeping shots of London where, you know, there are no people, no cars, nothing.
Impossible.
And, yeah, that was special effects.
There was a thank you at the end in the credits to the people of London for staying out of the way.
I think the people of London are way more polite than the people of New York when it comes to that.
Yeah, I'm sure you're right about that.
I happen to be one of those people on more than one occasion who just pushed on crossing the street anyway when I was told not to.
Yeah, I saw that in person. Kay and I had just watched the movie In Time, which is this Justin Timberlake movie about a future where people pay for things with the amount of time they've got left to live. And it was interesting, but it starred Cillian Murphy, who plays Jim in 28 Days Later. And, I know him from like the Batman Begins movie and in Sunshine, and there's an amazing movie called Breakfast on Pluto that he's the lead in. That's just phenomenal, and he's great, and he is really good in 28 Days Later.
He was also in Cold Mountain. Do you remember his part in that?
I actually did not see that movie.
He plays a Union soldier who waylays Queen Amidala.
Oh, really?
What's her name?
Her.
Natalie Portman.
Yeah.
Her. Yeah.
Natalie Portman is a woman who is probably a widow, although she can't confirm it. Her husband is a Confederate soldier off at war. And Jude Law's character, who is a deserter from the Confederate Army, is staying with her. And three Union soldiers show up, and they're going to rape her and take all of her food and maybe abuse her baby. And Cillian Murphy is one of them, although he's the most sympathetic of the bunch. He doesn't really want to hurt anybody. He's just, you know, following along and trying to stay alive. And she ends up shooting him in the back as he's running away.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's grim.
Good on her. Speaking of rape, let's get back to 28 Days Later.
So let's get to the very beginning of the film, because it doesn't actually open with the character of Jim waking up in the hospital.
Right.
It opens in a laboratory. And actually, it opens with newsreel footage of really violent acts. We see executions, we see riots, you know, we see brawls and fights and things, and it's all real stuff. You know, it's not staged; it's just stock footage. And we see this montage of it, and then we see that there's a chimp who's strapped down to a table, and he's being forced to watch all this stuff.
Right.
And then some animal rights activists break in, but it turns out before they can free any of these chimps, there is one scientist who's working late, and he explains what we heard in the very opening clip of this podcast, that in order to cure this human propensity for violence and rage, they first had to induce it, and that is the rage virus, which the evil animal rights activists release into the world.
Yeah, because they're just wanting to free those prisoners that they've got there. They don't realize how truly dangerous it is.
Yeah.
Well, this is a continuing theme in the first and the second movie, and it doesn't just occur. It occurs several times, this good intentions leading to catastrophic events.
Yeah, particularly in the second movie, which we'll get to that.
Well, it's great, the whole, like, man folly. You know, it's just this you know, these things where
right.
we screw around and things right. that we shouldn't be screwing around with, and it ends up, you know, kicking our ass.
Even the people that are trying to put an end to all that screwing around, they're still screwing around.
Oh, man, when will you learn?
So Jim apparently was a bike messenger, and he got in a wreck the day, I guess, when the shit hit the fan, or just after thereabouts, which is a little implausible that he could have laid there in a coma with nobody attending to him, you know, and just an IV bag to keep him hydrated for 28 days.
Yeah.
So we kind of have to overlook that a little bit. Maybe there was some heroic nurse who wouldn't leave her post, and even when everything was going to hell, she was, you know, changing IV bags. But
yeah, because his IV bag was still, you know, half full. So
was it?
Yeah, there was
still
fluid
in it. I just figured that he woke up
it.
When he was feeling really thirsty.
Yeah, there was definitely, you know, there's some of that you just kind of got to go with, I think. But yeah, it was a little goofy.
He was on the Fast Five IV diet.
Maybe that was it. He was slim when he woke up, so that was maybe it worked.
Yeah.
I liked how they had the obvious wound in his head where his head had been worked on. You know, And when they do a brain surgery like that, I mean, a lot of times they'll induce a coma, you know, to keep you out. So if it was a medically induced coma, you know, maybe there would have been some sort of system set up to keep him down and keep him healthy. You know, I don't know. And also the hospital, maybe even it was 28 days after the outbreak, maybe, you know, 20 days after the outbreak, there were still people in there working. You know, you don't know. So.
And a virus that spreads the way the rage virus did, well, a sort of a spread like that starts off very slow, you know, with very few cases reported, and then there's an exponential sort of doubling, and with any exponential process, you get this long, slow buildup, and then, boom, you know, it really just explodes. But with the rage virus, because the effects come on so quickly, I think that whole process would be accelerated, because,
yeah.
Well, I don't know. I mean, obviously, the infected can hang around for a while, so maybe there were a few people who were infected and who were running around infecting a few people. Maybe a lot of them were contained early. Maybe there was several attempts to, you know, eradicate the virus that seemed to be successful for a time. You know, and it seemed like they beat it. And then one or two people, you know, who slipped through the cracks started it all over again. I could imagine that happening.
I mean, both movies show how quickly the thing can spread. You know, if it just one infected, you know, gets into the populace, I mean, it can just grow like wildfire.
Oh, I just kept saying, oh my God, oh my God.
Yes.
The movies are just so in your face, fast, and.
Well, they're both. And 28 Days Later has this amazing, like, sad tone to it. You know, it's got action-packed moments, and it's even got a few humorous moments. You know, one of my few gripes with the film has to do with one of the, you know, quote-unquote humorous moments. But the entire movie has just this heavy sort of somber tone, and it's very serious, and it's very dire. And I really appreciated that.
Don't you feel that way about the serious zombie films? Not the comedic ones, of course, but...
Well, some do, but some tend to lean towards action films. So it becomes more about bang, bang, and blood, and heads exploding and stuff. And there's not that sort of somber, sort of downbeat sort of tone. And I really think 28 Days Later, that's something that it does very different from a lot of those movies.
Wow.
You know, it keeps it very down.
It is very sad. It's like the Walking Dead comic book series, very bleak and... hopeless and despairing, and I found 28 Days really menacing from the beginning, and suspected what turned out to be the case, as we'll talk about. So the menace that I perceived in that film, just about these women moving around in what looked like a man's world, or at least in that part of the world, you know, that was really effective to me, because I just kept. I was really dreading what turned out to be the case. So.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah.
So far we've talked about Jim. Let's get all the other characters into play here. Jim goes wandering around in London. He encounters the infected in a scene I just love. He wanders into the church, and in big graffiti letters written on the wall, it says, "Repent. The end is extremely fucking nigh." But we get the message
right.
In reverse order, because we see the bottom letters, the bottom words first. You know, if the camera pans up and pulls back, then we finally see the whole message.
Mm-hmm.
And he just walks right into the infected, finds out, you know, the hard way that they are not to be reasoned with, and he goes running through the streets, and he's doomed. But then two other characters, Selena and a guy who doesn't live long enough for me to remember his name, they're standing.
I think it's Mark, but I'm not
Mark?
Sure.
Okay, yeah, that rings a bell. They're standing by with Molotov cocktails, and they've also wired a gas station to blow up when the infected are next to it. And so basically they save Jim, and then they take him down into the London Tube station, and they've got a little gift shop, basically, where they just pull the grate down, and that is their little, you know, safe space, their panic room, so to speak. And then we get... the exposition as to what has happened.
So who are you? We are from a hospital, yeah?
Are you a doctor?
He's not a doctor, he's a patient.
Look, I'm a bicycle courier. I was riding a package from Farringdon to Shaftesbury Avenue and a car cut across me. And then I wake up today in hospital. I wake up and I'm hallucinating, or I'm...
What's your name?
Jim.
I'm Mark. This is Selena. Okay, Jim. I've got some bad news.
It started as writing. And right from the beginning, you knew this was different. Because it was happening in small villages, market towns. And then it wasn't on the TV anymore. It was in the street outside. It was coming through your windows. It was a virus. An infection. You didn't need a doctor to tell you that. It was the blood. Or something in the blood. By the time they tried to evacuate the cities, it was already too late. The infection was everywhere. The army blockades were overrun. And that's when the extras started. The day before the TV and radio stopped broadcasting, there were reports of infection in Paris and New York. We didn't hear anything more after that.
What about the government? What are they doing?
There's no government.
Of course there's a government. There's always a government. They're in a bunker or a plane.
No, there's no government, no police, no army, no TV, no radio, no electricity. You're the first uninfected person we've seen in 6 days.
Where's your family?
They're dead, like Selena's.
Yours will be dead too.
Look, I have to find them. They live in Deptford. I can walk it, okay?
Well, you'll go and come back, yeah?
Yes, fucking...
You won't!
Yes!
No one ever comes back.
So Jim decides that he absolutely, positively has to find his parents, although Selena and Mark are absolutely certain that his parents are dead. And so, having nothing better to do, they accompany him on a journey to his home, where, sure enough, they find his parents have committed suicide. So Selena tells Mark, you know, you should be grateful. They got to choose the way they died, and they died together, and they died peacefully. You know, they didn't become raving maniacs and rip each other to pieces.
They died peacefully. You should be grateful.
Oh, grateful.
My parents and my sisters, we went to Paddington Station, hoping maybe we could get on a plane, maybe we could buy our way onto a plane. I remember my dad had all this cash, even though cash was completely useless. About 20,000 other people had the same idea. The crowd was surging. I lost my grip on my sister's hand. I remember the ground was soft. I looked down and I was standing on all these people. Like a carpet. People who had fallen, and somewhere in the crowd they were infected. It spread fast. No one could run. All you could do was climb. Climb over more people. So I did that. I climbed. And I got up on top of this kiosk. Looking down, you couldn't tell which faces were infected and which weren't. And I saw my dad. Not my mum or my sister. My dad. His face.
I think this is something that needs to be addressed at some point. There are no actual zombies in this film, and yet we're talking about it on the Z-Realm podcast. But so many elements of the zombie apocalypse narrative are in place here. You know, the the infection that spreads and the people around you turning from people into monsters and basically the people who made society possible. You know, this vast, technologically enabled, very sophisticated society suddenly degenerates because everybody becomes a bloodthirsty, raving maniac.
Right. But they don't seem to, like, eat the person so much as just bite them and spread the virus. It's, you know.
It's as if the virus is directing their behavior to spread itself, and people are just consumed with rage. They don't just bite. You know, they punch, they hit, they scratch, they scream, they vomit blood at people. You know, they're just, and when there's nobody else around, no non-infected person around, they seem calm. You know, they sit passively, but then when they see somebody who could be infected, then the rage virus kicks in and they are consumed with this violent rage.
Which is kind of the way, I guess, a virus actually spreads. I mean, it's just that's the virus's job is to replicate itself and spread itself. And, you know, it does that at the expense of the host. And, you know, if it's a virus, that would make sense that would be their goal.
Yeah, you know, they seem to just be running, but the rage is giving them so much energy that I don't remember them sitting like zombies, just sort of going into a neutral place until they smell some flesh or something. They're running through the countryside. They're running really fast. They're enraged and flying through and screaming. And they don't seem to be attacking each other, or are they?
No, they don't attack each other. But remember the scene in the church when Jim goes in and he's up on the balcony and he looks down. He sees all these dead bodies down in the pews down below. And he says, hello. And then two of the dead bodies lurch up and turn around and look at him. And then they go for him.
Right.
When there's nobody around, they conserve their energy, which makes sense, again, from the virus's point of view.
Mm-hmm. You know,
the virus's job is to propagate itself, to spread the infection.
Right.
And when there's nobody around to infect, you just shut down, you save your resources, you wait.
Mm-hmm. Which makes sense.
Which makes the whole film just all the more, I think, pertinent and kind of creepy and just relevant. Because as much meaning as I find in the whole zombie apocalypse narrative, I'm not really worried about zombies. It's just not on my list of concerns. But bioterrorism, you know, or novel viruses getting into the population and spreading quickly, that is something that it's not just me that's concerned about it. I mean, fortunately, we have things like the CDC and whole government organizations and contingency plans and people thinking about, okay, how do we contain viruses in this age where people can jump on a plane and be on the other side of the world in half a day?
No, absolutely. I mean, they faced that when the SARS epidemic came out, you know, when it was, you know, that was a big topic, was, you know, how easy that thing was going to be to spread. And, you know, luckily, I guess that was controlled.
SARS, bird flu, swine flu.
Yeah, except that our side of the sort of the speculative divide, the CDC is usually responsible for the spread of the viruses.
Well, that's the thing, too. I mean, there's so I wouldn't say it's easy, but it's possible, you know, with all the bio weapons and stuff that are out there and the different things and the way people understand viruses more. If some, you know, nut job somewhere wanted to create something to cause havoc, I mean, they could definitely do it. And you know,
dwindling resources and growing populations. And
how did you know? I mean, how did you know he was infected?
The blood.
Yeah, but there was blood everywhere. It was on me. It was on you.
I didn't know he was infected, okay? He knew. I could see it in his face. Look, if someone gets infected, you've got between 10 and 20 seconds to kill them. It might be your brother or your sister or your oldest friend. It makes no difference. And just so you know where you stand, if it happens to you, I'll do it in a heartbeat. He was full of plans. Have you got any plans, Jim? Do you want us to find a cure and save the world or just fall in love and fuck? Plans are pointless. Staying alive is as good as it gets.
So that clip we heard was this amazing moment when they're there at Mark's parents' house and the infected break in and Mark ends up getting bitten or getting blood sprayed in his face, and he begins the transformation immediately. And he, boy, he is put down with extreme prejudice. And, you know, this is when it really starts to sink into Jim that this is something that happens quickly, and it must be answered quickly.
Yeah, it's not like in other zombie films where, you know, some character might get bitten and it's a few hours while they change. And, you know, there's discussion of putting them down before they change or letting them go, like Jim and The Walking Dead.
Mm-hmm.
Here, you really have to make an instantaneous decision. And this sort of ties into the what I think was done with less grace in The Walking Dead, the whole survival animal notion, where the person who can just put emotion and sentimentality aside and just do what needs doing in the moment, even if it's brutal murder, is the person who survives. And Selena seems to be that person.
She's obviously seen a lot. You know, they don't really talk a whole lot about kind of what she's done and what she's seen, but she's got it figured out. And you know, as she tells Jim in that clip, you know, if it happens to him, same thing is going to happen. She's going to put him down too. You know, she is definitely looking out for number one.
Yeah, but the story transforms in that they start to look out for each other, and he ultimately is the one who saves her, and she, of course, does waver, doesn't immediately kill him. When there's a suspicion that he may be infected, because when he comes back to save her, he's bloody and running and desperate, can't tell.
That whole, like, tone and feeling changes when they meet the next characters. That we meet, which is Jim and Selena are moving through the city, and they see like Christmas lights in an apartment high above the city. And they notice them, and they're like, what's that? They start to move into the building and try to get, you know, up to where these lights are. And they end up being chased by the infected as they climb the stairwell. And it's an amazing scene. And then they meet Frank and his daughter.
And Frank is wearing police riot gear, and he's got this big shield.
Right.
And he's acting like RoboCop, and then and they don't know what the hell to expect, and then he's like, cup of tea or whatever. He's just like so sort of kind and gentle. And
yeah, and that's Brendan Gleeson, and he's awesome. I mean, he's been in so much great stuff.
What else has he been in? I didn't recognize him.
He was the sheriff in Lake Placid. He was probably, I don't know if you'd say the star or the co-star of this great movie called In Bruges.
I loved In Bruges.
Yeah. And, you know, he's been in a ton of stuff, and he does a great American accent. And I mean, the guy's just great. And he's super in this. He's so likable. He's just like this teddy bear guy. And you just, you know, he's friendly. He's kind of soft-spoken. He doesn't make the best choices when he's driving his cab, but, you know.
But Frank and his daughter are trying to hold out in this high-rise apartment building, but they're basically running out of water.
Yeah, let's play the running out of water clip, because it's a really good clip and kind of sets up a lot of the kind of environmental concerns.
Okay.
We lost water pressure 3 weeks ago. For a while, I thought we'd be okay with the water. We had a flat, cisterns and tanks. It vanished so quick, you wouldn't believe. You drink it, it evaporates, turns stagnant.
All empty.
It hasn't rained in 10 days. You can set up a plastic sheet to catch dew and condensation, trap it somehow. Saw it on TV once, but you can't make it work. You'd never think it. Needing rain so badly. Not in fucking England. Jim, we're not going to be able to stay here.
So they cannot stay in this high-rise apartment building in London. But they do have hope, because they hear Frank's got this hand-cranked radio, and I've got one of these as well, and it's also a flashlight, and you can also charge cell phones off of it, which is a pretty cool thing to have.
Dynamo, it's called.
Yeah. So they can't stay there, But they've got this army transmission that they're picking up saying, you know, we have safety, we have food, we have water, we have the answer to infection, come here.
Right.
And so everybody piles into Frank's cab and they drive north. And along the way, Jim, who is kind of an innocent and who escaped, you know, he basically was in a coma and slept through all of the major violence, actually has to kill somebody. He kills a kid who is infected and who attacks him in a restaurant where he goes exploring.
That was super heavy.
There's
and he doesn't talk about it either. You know, he does it, and they go, hey, did you see anything in there? And he just says, no.
Yeah.
You know, does not want to talk about that, which is understandable.
There's a happy scene where they go into a supermarket and they load up on stuff.
There's a nice shot.
What's that?
You get that consumer fantasy.
Yeah, the consumer fantasy where you're the last person left in the world. You can go into the store and take anything you want, which is, you know, from Dawn of the Dead.
Yeah.
But there's a neat shot where they show the produce bins and everything is rotten except this one bin of apples. And Frank says, irradiated.
That's great.
this thing where he's just getting waxing all poetic over the you know, the whiskey and stuff.
Jim's about to take some shit bottle of whiskey off the shelf, and Frank's like,
now, single malt, 16-year-old, tart with full flavor, warmer, not aggressive, peaty aftertaste. Takes out the fire, but leaves in the warmth.
So, did anybody else kind of get pissed off when Frank just decided, what the hell, let's just drive up over the tops of all these stalled cars in the tunnel?
Yeah, it's unrealistic, but...
It was completely unrealistic. I mean, he's got his kid in the car with him.
Yeah,
and that was my one, like, real kind of beef with the movie.
When he went through that tunnel as if he was going to make it out alive, right?
Yeah, I was just like, dude, no way that the guy would do that. He was so concerned about his daughter, but he's like, ah, fuck it, let's just go hauling ass. And not that it was bad enough that he was doing that, but they were all laughing, like, woo-hoo.
Right. Yeah, like, we're having fun now.
But you know, again, you know, how pissed off do I want to get about this, you know, scene in a zombie movie? You know.
Exactly.
When there's much good stuff in this film.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You know, they're driving north, and they pass some other city, and I forget which one it is, but the whole city is on fire. Like, there's a great shot where the highway is empty. We see just Frank's cab on the highway, and then the camera is slowly tilting up, and we see the horizon. You know, we see the highway receding, you know, doing that linear perspective thing, just going off to a dot. And then up, we see the horizon, and up a little more, and it's like there's cloud on the horizon, or it's a dark horizon. And then up a little more, and we see that it's fire burning and just filling the sky with black smoke. And it's just a great, really understated shot at first, but then when you get the whole thing, it's just astounding. And that's what really makes this film for me. It's just these little but super iconic, just super memorable images.
Yeah, it's full of that kind of stuff, too. You know, it's not like there's just that one shot you could talk about. I mean, it's just shot after shot after shot of that kind of stuff where it's just, it's a different level of stuff than you would expect from what you typically get in a zombie movie.
We should mention that this first one was directed by Danny Boyle, who I know mainly as the director of Trainspotting, but he's done a lot of other things as well. Slumdog Millionaire is probably his most popular film to date.
Well, it's the 27 Hours or whatever. That thing was nominated for Academy Awards and stuff.
27 Hours. No relation to 28 Days or Weeks?
Nope. That's the one where the guy falls in the hole and has to cut his own arm off to survive. So.
Oh, I read that guy's story in Outside Magazine when that first happened years ago. That's a pretty amazing story.
Yes.
I have to... I would have to pump myself up to see that movie because, zombie movie, that actually happened.
Yeah, absolutely. I can deal with zombies, but folks really cutting their arm off, I don't know.
But wow, how courageous.
But no, he's a real deal director. I mean, he made a science fiction movie called Sunshine that I think is brilliant. And it's very, very reminiscent of, the thing with Sam Neill, Event Horizon.
Oh.
It really reminds me of that.
I actually saw that. That was a creepy movie.
It's a damn creepy movie, and Sunshine is very much along those lines. But I really like it.
Do you know what I was thinking?
You were thinking that you'll never hear another piece of original music ever again. You'll never read a book that hasn't already been written. Or see a film that hasn't already been shot.
That's what you were thinking.
No. I was thinking I was wrong.
But what?
All the death. All the shit. It doesn't really mean anything to Frank and Hannah because... Well, she's got a dad and he's got his daughter, so...
Cheeky monkey.
I was wrong when I said that staying alive is as good as it gets.
See, that's what I was thinking.
Was it?
You stole my thought.
Sorry.
It's okay. You can keep it.
It's getting late. I think we better stay here for the night.
The thing where the zombies spit to spread the infection, you know, there's like this vomiting of blood.
Oh, yeah.
That is some new stuff. I mean, I don't know if I've seen that before or since.
Well, did we actually see anyone get infected just by that? Certainly in 28 weeks later when he kisses his wife, yes. But.
Right.
Well, that's a great question because it sets up the next big event in the film. They all get to the place that the radio broadcast said they should go, and they find an abandoned roadblock where there are dead soldiers around. And there's one dead soldier who's up on a scaffolding, and there's a crow eating him. And Frank is incensed by this. He had all his hopes invested in this, and he gets so angry, and he's shouting at the crow, and he bangs on the scaffolding. And one drop of blood falls from the soldier and lands right in Frank's eye. And then he clutches his eye and he realizes, oh, shit, this is it, I'm done. And he says to his daughter, I love you, stay away from me, get away, get away. And then he starts to change. And everybody is freaked out, nobody knows what to do. And then the soldiers pop up, shoot Frank, tell everybody to stay away from his body, and then they take the remaining three survivors back to this big mansion where they have set up their defenses.
And then you meet the commander, who's played by Christopher Eccleston.
Yes, yes, who was the Doctor Who after the series came out of like a 7-year hiatus.
Mm-hmm.
He was the new Doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And I had seen 28 Days Later first, and he's such a different character, you know, that I didn't even recognize him in Doctor Who. As the same actor from 28 Days Later. And when I saw the film again later, I was like, oh, wow, that's Doctor Who.
Doctor Who. Yeah, I did the same thing the other night when I watched it. I was like, oh, shit. Because he's great. He's a great doctor, I thought.
He's a great actor. He's really, really good. Did you see Elizabeth Golden Years?
No, I didn't see that.
No, it was the sequel to, you know, the Cate Blanchett film Elizabeth.
Mm-hmm.
Plays Queen Elizabeth, and he's in that as well. And he's a really good actor. He's a very versatile character actor.
That's cool.
How's she doing?
Well, she's lost her dad, Jim. That's how she is. It's all fucked.
What do you mean? Is what Frank says. She's okay. She's tough and she's strong and she'll cope just like I'll cope and just like you'll cope.
I don't want her to have to fucking cope. I want her to be okay. But
dad had a dad, it was okay. It was okay for them, and it was okay for us. It was all just fucked.
But we find out, and we got to speed things along, I think, a little bit. basically, to keep morale up, this army officer has promised this group of men who, you know, are not the sharpest tools in the shed, to say the least, that basically to give them a reason to go on, he has promised them women. And Olga, you said you had this intuition early on.
Yeah, well, because, you know, we find this, well, first of all, I think it's really great that a main character is a female, a black woman. So, you know, the fact that it's a foreign film already makes sense because foreign films are more likely than American films. Hopefully that's changing. Just to, without any fanfare, to have a non-white, non-male lead and just have it be sort of a matter of course and not something that you make a big deal out of. And then when Hannah lost her dad, and I was just like, oh, shit, here's a teenage girl. Now what? I was just dreading. I just thought, here are two women. One is really strong and she could totally take care of herself, but here's this teenage girl. What's going to happen? And yeah, it happened. It's like, you know, it was a ruse. They send out this signal, essentially a dangling carrot to anyone that would come. And I'm sure the plan was to lure women to the site, to the military base, and to either have the men disappear or somehow convince them to be part of the situation.
And Christopher Eccleston's character, I wish I could remember the character. You know what? There's IMDb. I'll just look. Hold on just a second.
He is Major Henry West.
Yes, you found it before I did, just as I did.
Look, we're grateful, okay? We're very grateful for your protection and just having found other people. But if we're going to stay here...
Who have you killed?
I haven't killed
since
anybody.
It began, who have you killed? You wouldn't be alive now if you hadn't killed somebody.
Child.
Yes.
But you had to.
Otherwise he'd have killed you. Survival.
I understand. I promised them women.
Eight days ago, I found Jones with his gun in his mouth. He said he was going to kill himself because there was no future. What could I say to him? We fight off the infected or we wait until they starve to death, and then what? What do nine men do except wait to die themselves? I moved us from the blockade, I set the radio broadcasting, and I promised them women. Because women mean a future.
So Major West actually wants to include Jim. I mean, it seems pretty obvious that Jim is an impediment to their plans. That, you know, what they really wanted was women. They didn't want, you know, skinny Jim, who's already sort of falling in love with Selena. He's just in the way, and in all likelihood, he would be killed. But without actually spelling out in detail what their plans are, there are scenes where Major West is trying to broach the subject to Jim to say, look, Jim, you can be one of us. You can be a part of this, you know, but it's going to be hard. There's something you're going to have to get used to. And he doesn't really spell it out, but it's not as if it's not ordained from the beginning that Jim is going to be executed so that, you know, the rest of the soldiers have free access to the women. But that's how it turns out. And there is, in fact, one soldier who has a bit of conscience, and they decide to kill him as well.
Yeah, he's like a drill sergeant or something, that guy. 'Cause, and he does not gotten to this plan. He doesn't like, he's seen, I think it's clear that these guys are falling apart, these old soldiers. I mean, they're acting like idiots and, you know, they're doing a lot of things that they probably shouldn't be doing. And I think all that stuff, there's just nuances to Christopher Eccleston's performance where it seemed clear to me that he was not happy with his soldiers and he was not, you know, thrilled with the way things were going and he was trying to keep a certain decorum. But he was in a situation where it was just getting worse and he needed to keep them together. And I don't think there was any part of him that was gleeful about the path that they were going down, but it was a thing that he had sort of accepted as a must to keep those guys under whatever control he could. And you know, that was one of the things that I thought was really impressive about his performance, was that it seemed like there was more going on there than just maybe a guy who, you know, was all happy about, you know, tricking women to come up there for, you know, raping and prisoning and stuff.
I think what's clear is that as their commander, he feels responsible for his men. And what he says that what made him adopt this new strategy was that he found one of his men with his gun in his mouth. And he was, you know, he had seen that there was no hope left. And this is the only thing he knew that would give his men hope. Well, there's one other character we need to introduce, a very important character, and it is, we get one in each film. There is one infected who is integral to the plot and who we see again and again, who plays a big role. And in this film, it is one of Major West's soldiers who had become infected, and they keep him chained up in a courtyard.
And lastly, meet Mela. Mela? Jim. Jim. Mela. Got infected 2 days ago.
Mitchell managed to knock him out cold and we got a chain round his neck.
Keeping him alive.
The idea was to learn something about infection. Have him teach me.
And has he?
In a way.
He's telling me he'll never bake bread, plant crops, raise livestock. He's telling me he's futureless. And eventually, he'll tell me how long the infected take to starve to death.
So, eventually, events take their natural course. The soldier with conscience is killed. Two soldiers who are absolute psychopaths, one of them is an absolute psychopath anyway, they get into a fight and Jim escapes. Now, Jim goes over the wall, and the two soldiers decide not to report that he's escaped, because if he's gone over the wall to the outside, he's as good as dead. So they go back, and they get on with the business of, you know, basically savoring the fact that they're about to rape these two women. And Jim goes back to the roadblock. He cranks this hand-cranked siren, you know, which, one, lets the soldiers know that he's still alive, and two, brings in a lot of infected. And then things get really crazy, and we get that, you know, that really creepy, iconic musical cue. And things, you know, lightning starts, and the infection starts to spread, because Jim sneaks back onto, and he draws some soldiers out, he kills them while they're out there, he gets back into the compound, into the grounds of the house, and he frees Private Mailer, the infected soldier. And that infected soldier starts the process of infecting the rest of the group. And it's really violent and really creepy. And Jim is just out in the rain. He's shirtless. He's bloodied. He's running around like a madman. He's got this crazed look in his eyes. And finally, he reunites with Selena and Hannah. But by this point, he's so crazed that Selena could very forgivably, you know, mistake him for one of the infected. And in fact, he rushes up to her without saying anything, and she has a machete in her hand, and she goes to chop him, and at the last minute she stops, because while he's got the crazed look in his eyes, she's experienced with this stuff, and she realizes, she sees that he is just a desperate, crazy person because of his circumstances, not because of infection.
It's a close call.
Yeah, and so it's interesting because I was just thinking that this film shares with the second film an adult protecting a child kind of being in dire circumstances herself each time. Well, there's a woman involved in the second film as well, but not just the woman. And there's a sense of kind of putting her, Selena puts, sort of uses her body as a shield for Hannah, and then there's that scene where she tries to get her to take a whole bunch of pills.
Yeah.
She's like, oh my God, they're going to rape you, and I just want you to kind of be incapacitated for it, you know? Like, and it's weird because afterwards Hannah's high because she obviously swallowed one or two of them, but it didn't seem like that scene really lasted long enough for her to get any pills down her. But she did. And then she's a little out of it and kind of high and not really 100%. But what I found interesting is this very clear cut, you know, that there's insanity and then there's malfeasance and then there's this very dogged, persistent, I will protect the weaker of me. Mm-hmm. You know, I will stand in and I will use my body as a shield and I will use whatever I can to protect this child, which is also continued in 28 months.
Weeks.
So Jim takes Selena and Hannah and they escape, right?
They do.
Yeah, well, we don't need to tell out all the details of the end of the film, but it has a pretty happy ending.
It was a wonderfully pleasant turnaround there at the end, because I mean the thing up until that point really had nothing much to, you know, give you any reason to hope, but you know at the end you do get that one little ray of sunshine and hope that things will be better.
And it turns out that, you know, it's just the infection is just confined to England and that the rest of the world is okay, and that brings us to the sequel, the 2007 film 28 Weeks Later, which opens during the time frame of 28 Days Later with Don, and who's played by Robert Carlyle from Trainspotting, and his wife, and I don't remember the wife's name, but they are basically in a darkened room, and they're preparing a meal, and there's some other people, it turns out, who are in this dark place, and it's a house or a cottage out in the country, and they're all sitting down to a meal together. And then a kid comes banging on the door, and they open the door, and it's bright daylight outside, and it's only dark inside, and they're only, you know, operating by candlelight because they've shut up all the windows and put, you know, they've boarded them up and they've put cloth up just to conceal themselves from the infected.
Mm-hmm.
And Don, you know, it's really easy to despise his character because he leaves his wife at a critical moment. He has to decide between going and fighting the infected, you know, in close quarters, in a seemingly hopeless situation, or just turning and running. And he turns and runs, and, you know, he sees his wife in the window, and she gets pulled away by the infected, and it's a really violent, horrible scene, and he gets away. And then flash forward, it's 7 months later, 28 weeks later, and all the infected have starved to death, and the U.S. military has occupied a portion of London, the Isle of Dogs, and they're bringing in basically the remaining surviving Brits of the world to repopulate England.
I've got a great clip to play right here, so let's listen to this clip.
We are headed for the Green Zone, our area of security and reconstruction designated as District 1. District 1 is located on the Isle of Dogs. Although the Isle of Dogs is completely safe, the surrounding area of London is not. There are a large number of bodies still left to be cleared from the original outbreak of infection. Rats and wild dogs are prevalent, as is disease. New arrivals are reminded, for their own safety, It is absolutely forbidden to cross the river and leave the security zone. You will be joining 15,000 civilians who are already resident in District 1. As we approach Union Home, you will notice a dramatically increased military presence. The U.S. Army is responsible for your safety. We will do everything we can do to make your repatriation as easy as possible. Inside District 1, however, we believe you'll be pleasantly surprised. We have hot and cold running water, 24-hour electricity, a medical center, a supermarket, and even a pub.
We're nearly home.
Two of the people being repatriated are the children of Don and his wife Alice, who we learned at the beginning of the film had been out of the country on a school holiday, and I think they were in Spain. So they know that their father is alive, and they see him on the train, and it turns out that Don is basically in charge of all the maintenance and building systems and things in the Isle of Dogs complex, which is called Zone 1, or the Green Zone, as they call it. And so he has all access. He's got the magic key card, which opens every door.
Which is a plot point, yeah.
It is a plot point, yes. And then the two kids are in bed, and we meet another character played by Jeremy Renner, who's about to be a mega superstar because he plays Hawkeye in the Avengers. Yeah. But he is a sniper who is on the roof of the buildings, and he jokes around with the other snipers. You know, they haven't seen any action. The infected were all dead by the time the military got there. But they basically have this game where they use their night scopes and their rifles, and they just watch the people in the high-rise apartments every night. And they see the kids bouncing on the bed, and then we cut to the kids, and Andy gets in bed with his sister Tammy and confesses to her that he's afraid he's going to forget what his mother's face looks like. And they had already spoken to their father about their mother's death, and the father lied to them and said that he saw her die when in fact he did not.
You're okay? Bad dream?
I get worried I'm gonna forget what she looks like.
You won't forget.
I don't even have a picture of her.
So they decide to escape, basically. It seems harmless to them. They're just going to go, you know, get off the Isle of Dogs, go into town, and go to their house and get a picture of their mother.
Right.
And just to cut to continuity, we find out that the mother is alive. The mother, like her son Andy, has one green eye and one brown eye. And when she gets bitten by one of the infected, when somebody becomes one of the infected, when they turn into one of these berserker maniacs, their eyes fill up with blood. And with her, the green eye stayed clear and the left eye filled up with blood. The brown eye filled up with blood. And the son has that same genetic abnormality. He's got one brown eye, one green eye. So she is actually infected, but she maintains her you know, rationality. She's still lucid.
Right,
but
she's a carrier.
She's a carrier. She doesn't have symptoms, but she can infect other people. They bring her back, they have her under restraints, and they find out, you know, they do blood tests, and another character, a major character in the film, Scarlet, who's the chief medical officer, figures out that, yes, she is infected, she's a carrier, but she doesn't show symptoms. So she's very important. You know, her DNA could be the secret, you know, the key that allows them to develop either a vaccine or a cure for the infection.
There's no question, sir. She has the virus. She's infected.
Why isn't she showing any symptoms?
I don't know.
Speculate.
A genetic abnormality which acts as some sort of natural immunity. But the virus is still in her blood and saliva, so technically she's not immune. She's a carrier.
Are you saying she has the ability to infect others?
Yes, sir. Absolutely. If this woman has natural immunity, she is incredibly valuable. Her blood could contain the key to a vaccine, even a cure.
But the chief military officer says, absolutely not. We're going to kill her. That's the protocol. You know, study her corpse. And before the military can get there, Don, who's figured out that his wife is still alive, uses his magic key card to go and tell her how sorry he is and how much he loves her. And she says, I love you, Don, and they kiss.
And that does not go so well for Mr. Don.
No. Or for her.
Or anybody, really.
Yeah, that's the truth.
Who's strapped to that examining table and who really doesn't know, doesn't really realize because she hasn't had any contact with anybody else.
Yeah, she doesn't know that she's infected.
No, because you see it in her eyes when he turns and she's like, oh, shit. You know, and he gouges her eyes out, which is apparently a thematic thing in the two movies.
Well, that was the thing. I mean, you were talking about that in regards to the first movie, but the, it isn't just I'm going to kill you and eat you. I mean, it's a vicious like attack and
rage.
Yeah, you know, when he gets in there and gouges her eyes out, I was just like, Jesus, dude, come on. Right.
Exactly.
That's a really disturbing sequence because Don, as he's changing at first, you know, he's just freaking out and vomiting blood and whatnot, and then he's banging on the windows, banging on the doors, he's just flailing in violence, and then he turns and sees his wife strapped to that table, and he rushes to her, and he hits her, and he bites her, and he's screaming at her, and, you know, spilling blood on her, and then he digs his thumbs into her eyes.
It was definitely heavy duty. I mean, that was and when Kay and I were watching it, she was just like, I'm going to go ahead and just kind of hide my eyes for this because she remembered what was happening. And I had no idea. I was just like, what do you mean? What's going to happen? What's happening? And, it was heavy.
Well, I, you know, from the moment the movie started, I was just so blown away and so freaked out and my nervous system was just completely strung out. And when he leaves his wife, the betrayal, the shock of it was so strong. And then when I see that, you know, she was carried into the green zone as a survivor, I forgave him because I realized it was a plot line.
But he had to do that. He's like Judas Iscariot, you know. If he doesn't betray Jesus, there are no gospels. There is no resurrection.
There's Christianity.
There's no salvation, yeah.
Right. Damn that Judas.
There can be no light without dark. So
yeah,
the guy was a completely loathsome sort of character, and the things that he does after he changes, you know, don't really improve.
And why does he continue? It's just like Captain Maillard in the first movie, where I was just surprised that he was still alive or running through that base, killing people. You know, that nobody had shot him dead yet. Same thing with Don; he just keeps appearing, and you know, with all those perfect marksmen and snipers and, you know, the brunt of the American force sitting there.
It was a bit of a stretch.
Yeah. It was just like that car ride through the tunnel over the other cars.
Yeah. It's just one of those things you kind of go, what a movie moment. You know, this isn't like real anymore, but, you know, it's a movie, so you allow those things here and there. And the Jeremy Renner character was interesting because, and we should get to this. I have a clip here let's play this clip and then we can come back and talk about that.
Whiskey 3, why have you stopped firing? Come in, Whiskey 3. Abandon selective targeting. Shoot everything. Targets are now three. We've lost control.
All units, this is Medical Commanding Officer Sierra Lima. Please be on the lookout for a young boy, age 12, name Andy. If he is located, he must be immediately evacuated from the containment zone.
We have to find Andy. We have to find him!
It's okay. We're gonna find him. I'm gonna find him. I promise. I'm gonna get him out of here. I'm gonna get you both out of here. Trust me.
General who's kind of in charge of the Green Zone, and this is, Don has changed after being in the room with his wife, and he has bitten people and spit on people, and the thing has done that sort of exponential growth, and now there's lots of infected running around, spreading the infection and attacking, innocent people, and after a while, they've got the snipers, including Jeremy Renner's character, on the rooftops, shooting zombies or infected. And then there's that moment where the commander just goes, target's free, shoot everything. And they're basically just going to wipe the place clean.
Well, they corral, they quarantine the people, right? As soon as they realize there was an outbreak, they put everybody into one room and they shut the lights and everybody's just really freaked out and kind of feels like Katrina or something. And then, of course, they're in an enclosed room, and as soon as there's an infected within that enclosed room, it's just complete and utter panic. So they go, once they are able to break out, there's a mass of people running, and amongst them are infected and not infected, and they're all running and they're all scared. They all look like they're enraged.
Sure. And from a distance, especially
amazing,
up on that. Yeah.
Yeah, it's an amazing scene when the snipers are just trying to kill the infected and not the people, and then they get that command to just kill everybody, and we're watching it through Doyle's point of view, because he's shooting at the infected only, and then he's just shooting everybody, and then he watches his buddy get bit, and he shoots him, and then he sees Andy, the kid, and something just snaps in him, and he's like, I'm done killing people. I'm going to save that kid.
I think at some point before that, he had heard the broadcast from the doctor who had said that there's a young boy named Andy, and we've got to get him out of here.
I think so.
It
seemed like nobody heard
possible.
It.
But, he does. I mean, he follows orders, and he shoots several uninfected people.
Yeah.
But then his fellow sniper on a rooftop calls out to him over the radio. He says, Doyle, and this is the only time we hear the word zombies, but he's screaming in panic, and he says, Doyle, and he says something about zombies, and Doyle looks over there. And I just have to say, this character played by Jeremy Remmer, his name is Doyle, seems like a compact version of Danny Boyle.
Yeah, you're right.
But, so he shoots his friend, but not the two infected who are attacking him, and then he's like, okay, I'm done.
Right.
And he goes down to ground level, and he finds the survivors who have holed up in the pub, and he says, okay, well, I'm getting out of here, because if you wait till morning, you're dead. And anybody who wants to come with me can. And, we've been on the call for over an hour now, and we can't really go through the plot with as much detail as we did the first film. But this is a really, to me, it's more action-oriented. There's less dialogue. There are scenes of, the empty city, which is pretty compelling. But I think what really struck me about this film was the fact that you have characters who seem like very central characters, and I'm thinking specifically of Doyle and Scarlet, mm-hmm. the medical officers, who are the children's protectors, who just die, just brutally, and without a backward glance at them, really. It's just, you know, run. Oh, there goes
right.
Doyle. He's dead.
Right.
Burned to death by the army. You know,
right.
run. Oh, Scarlet just beaten to death by Dawn.
Right.
But the plot continues, and there's not a lot of time spent grieving for them or even acknowledging their death. It's just, oh, okay, another one down.
Well, it's not a Hollywood movie, you know, where the hero survives to the bitter end. And I've always wanted to make a movie where it's just a series of these really high suspense scenes, and you're following your hero, and then the hero does fall, and he does die. And then suspenseful scene of somebody escaping, and they do die. And it's just a whole series of these.
That would be cool if that was like you had a changing, sort of morphing central character, you know, each time another person died, you'd start following somebody else.
Right. So what you'd get is you get like really heightened, your nervous system is just really, really heightened. You're in a lot of suspense, and you get a few minutes of being invested in this character, and then they're lost.
You'd have to have some times, though, where you'd surprise it. The person that looked like they're going to die for sure, you know, would live, that kind of thing.
No,
people get.
It's just abuse. It's just emotional abuse all the way.
And have to kill all the children, because that would be the thing that would.
You know, so that there is, because this whole Hollywood, the hero against all odds survives business is just, it's too coddly, man.
Well, you know, at the point where the doctor and the Jeremy Renner character, when they die, I mean, they have had that conversation where she's explained
right.
about his blood and about it being important and about how that kid's life is more important than anybody's life. And actually, when she says that to the Doyle character, I was just like, wow, that's heavy to even, you know, because
right.
you think about your job. Like, I've got a job, and you know, there are people where I work who think that what I do is extremely important, and that if I don't do my job properly, it is a very important and serious thing. But I was thinking, wow, I can't even imagine having that kind of responsibility where it's like, this is a thing
right.
that could like be the difference between the, you know, the human race continuing and not, and you need to get him out of here. I don't want that responsibility.
Okay, but what did it actually wind up turning into?
Exactly. It actually ended up being the opposite of that.
Exactly.
But,
they kept this vector alive and spread it.
Yes. Yes. It got escaped.
Is a major theme in both films is that people doing what they think is the right thing produces disastrous consequences. Like when the infection first starts, you know, the soldiers quarantine all of the civilian
right.
people in what they think is a safe place
it's
to
right.
protect them. But what they've done is just concentrate them so they can all get infected in a really short span of time
right.
and then be completely integrated with, you know, the rest of the people.
Right.
And then Doyle and Scarlet both decide to sacrifice their own lives to protect these two children who are the most important people in the world, really. But it turns out that in sacrificing themselves, in protecting these children, they have condemned the whole world because they allow the infection to spread from England across the channel to the continent. And, you know, the final scene is just the infected running through tunnels, and then they come up and they're at the Eiffel Tower. And
yeah.
we know that the infection has spread to France.
Yeah. So really, the most important person out of those four is Scarlet, because she had the most knowledge. You know, she didn't bother to then tell Tammy, the older sister, that hey, your brother's important because of this, this, and this, and this is why you need to get him to a medical facility. No. You know, so then she dies, and the two kids have no idea, and then just innocently go off like what was that figure in the 1800s?
Did the pilot know that the kid
no.
was important?
No.
That's because
Jeremy Renner had not
explained
it.
This is Harold Perrineau, who plays
yeah.
Michael on Lost.
And Link on Matrix.
Yes. And his name in the film is Flynn, and he is a good friend of Doyle. And he's going to sacrifice everything to save his friend Doyle. And he doesn't want to take anybody else, any civilians. But the
well,
two
he knows
kids
get
are the
their
only
asses
ones.
Out, yeah.
the only two kids who, the only two people who make it to the final rendezvous point, which is Wembley Stadium, where he lands the helicopter, are the son and the daughter, Tammy and Andy. And he takes pity on them, and he rescues them, and he flies them across the English Channel, where they spread the infection further.
Right.
So everybody is making a noble sacrifice, and every noble sacrifice makes matters worse.
Right.
It seems to be a running theme in both films.
It's a running theme in our civilization.
I would agree with that if every decision was being made on what was going to render the highest profit margin. But, you know, I think that's more the deciding factor than what's for the best. I want to say, and I cannot praise it highly enough, but there's an amazing scene where the Flynn character flies in on a helicopter to rescue the other members of the team
right.
out of a field that is swarming with zombies, with infected, and he just tips the helicopter down
yes.
and the rotor blade just mows through them, and it is some of the most wonderful carnage I've ever seen in a movie. It is completely over the top, and I must have watched that scene four or five times just to kind of really soak it up, and it's phenomenal effect work.
Yeah, I had a hard time even understanding it. I had to ask Cameron to explain it to me. I'm like, how did he do that? Where did those blades? Is he just doing that with the landing blades? You know, meanwhile, that character Sam, who's a scaredy cat and wouldn't follow Doyle's command to run in a zigzag fashion
right.
to avoid the bad marksman sniper and jumps up onto the helicopter because it's all about me, me, me. I'm the one that's going to escape. And meanwhile, he's being flung through the crowd.
Yeah, he's getting all that zombie juice all over him. He's not going to make it.
No, he's not going to make it.
This is madness. What's happening?
They're shooting everybody.
Why? It makes no sense.
It makes perfect sense. It's code red. One, kill the infected. Step two, containment. If containment fails, step three, extermination. Now they won't stop until everyone is dead.
So what do we do? I mean, I'm not sitting around here to get exterminated. We've got to get out of here.
We take one step out of that door. The infected don't get us. The snipers will.
Well, you don't have a choice, my friend. Right now, it's dark out there. Snipers can see you through their night scopes, but at least you have some limited cover from the infected. But, you know, if you want to wait till sunup, well, you're as good as dead.
This is the beginning of the fast, crazy, enraged, super
yeah.
strong, infected zombies, and the way that they're filmed in this super fast and sometimes slowed down, sort of like a strobe effect kind of style, which is, to me, reminiscent of what Aronofsky used for the drug and dream sequences in Requiem for a Dream, and that was a very innovative use that Aronofsky used, and I don't know if this is the same thing. I don't think it is, but it has a very similar kind of effect because it makes it hyper real and very staccato and very scary because in Aronofsky's use of it, the characters are stationary; they're not coming at you, and these zombies are coming at you. And I first noticed it in Dead Set, which is a much more recent series, the British zombie series, and it just immediately, you know, as soon as somebody's infected and everything happens really fast and then boom, they're coming at you and all of reality just shifts instantly.
Yeah, it's very unsettling,
yeah.
all that kind of strobing light and
yeah.
the sound. I mean, there's There's the scenes that are very reminiscent of the stuff from Cloverfield when they're in the subway, and also the conclusion of Silence of the Lambs, where they're essentially operating in complete darkness and using a night vision scope to see their way around. And that stuff's just completely just puts you right on edge. Right.
Well, it's just like when Don, at the beginning, when Don escapes and he betrays his wife and he leaves her there, and he's in the boat and he's just going, oh, shit, oh, shit, oh, shit, oh, shit, oh, shit, oh, shit, oh, shit. That's how I was feeling.
Yeah, I was thinking, asshole, asshole, asshole.
Right. Well, for sure, but for sure.
Talking about stylistic influences, you mentioned Requiem for a Dream, which came out in 2000. 28 Days Later comes out in 2002. And while it's not a zombie film exactly, it is, shares many, many things in common with zombie films, and it introduces the sprinting zombie. So that's 2002. Zack Snyder's remake of Dawn of the Dead came out in 2004.
Mm.
And that's where we get actual undead zombies, which sprint. And so you can sort of trace these stylistic innovations from film to film to film. And I think that's one of the reasons why 28 Days Later is such an important film. I think it sort of upped the ante in terms of the threat level of the zombies in zombie films generally.
Right,
because one could take you down. You didn't need a horde like you do in the slower zombie movies.
Just one person infected can very quickly infect a huge number of people because, they can run fast. They're not looking to eat you. They're just furious at you for no reason, and they can spit their blood at you. Just a scratch will do it, and you're a zombie. You're one of them in just a few seconds.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think we've gotten people who grew up with the Romero films can even fantasize about being in that world because you're kind of powerful in that world. You're much stronger than any one zombie, and you can you can make your way in that world once you understand the rules. And in this world, even if you know the rules, your chances are slim.
Well, we've talked before about how these zombie movies, they represent, a world where all of a sudden, once you get the zombie thing kind of figured out, what you're more scared of are the, the humans that are left alive. And in 28 Days Later, you're really only, until you meet those soldiers at the end, you're only really afraid of the infected. And, this movie, right off the bat, I mean, you've got these army guys just mowing people down with machine guns. And that's, they're who kill the Jeremy Renner character. It is the man's, the man killing man. It's not the infected killing man, killing the men in the sequel.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, even when the zombies are much, much more menacing and much more threatening, still the ones to look out for are the living humans.
Yeah, the ones with guns. Watch out.
Yeah, the ones with guns and nerve gas and flamethrowers and jet fighters and standing orders,
room for
discretion, no room for compassion, no room for individual initiative or thinking on your feet. It's just, okay, stage one failed, stage two failed, now we're on to stage three. Just kill them all.
Just do it.
Right. Well, there was one dissenter, and there was one who decided to think on his feet. And
there were three.
Compassion. Well, one soldier. I'm talking about as far as following orders. She had already flown the coop, the Major Scarlet. She was already...
Well, she had her Hippocratic Oath to think of, so...
Exactly, because she's a doctor. She's a doctor first,
right.
Soldier second. She's not a soldier. She's just in the military. But Doyle, the soldier, he decides to think about it and go the other way. And what does he get? He gets burned alive by friendly fire, literally. Friendly fire.
Yeah,
that's good. But I think both these films kind of earn their place in the zombie canon. I mean, even though they're not strictly zombie, zombies in the films. I mean, it is zombie themes all the way through it, and it's these are two of the best examples of zombie stuff that have come out in the past 20 years.
Well, I think it's also important to point out that Zombieland, with the word zombie in the title,
mm-hmm.
is very much along the lines of 28 Days Later and 28 Weeks Later. The zombies in that film are not corpses. They are people driven mad by a virus, And, you know, they don't have to be shot in the head. You don't have to destroy the brain. They're just regular people, but they're regular people with no sense of humanity left, no compassion, just violent rage and just the irresistible urge to do violence.
Do they devour? I can't remember in Zombieland. Do they
in Zombieland, they do eat people, but you know, I watched the DVD commentary, and it's very explicit that they're not undead. They are living people who are just driven to violence by whatever it is that has infected them. Well, this has been a pretty long episode, I think, for the Z-Realm podcast, but we have this tradition of mentioning at the end other media that isn't necessarily zombie related, but which might be of interest to people who like the sorts of films that we like. And Marty, I know that you recently saw The Hunger Games, as did I, and we both liked it, but at the beginning or before The Hunger Games, we both saw the extended new trailer for Prometheus.
Yes.
Oh, and do you want to say anything about that?
I just cannot wait. It's going to, I'm really hoping it's going to be fantastic. I actually have my buddy Leith is coming in, and we're going to go try to see it in IMAX. It's a event. This is going to be a special occasion.
When is it opening?
June 16th, I think.
Oh, okay.
Or in that area. I'm not exactly sure.
Soon.
But, yeah, it looks great.
But not soon enough.
No, nowhere near soon enough. And I'm actually going to have to wait about a week and a half to go see it because that's when he can get up here. So
I'm more excited about the Mermaid Parade, but okay.
Let's talk about The Hunger Games because, you know, that's obviously the most popular film in America, 3 weeks running. I know you said you liked it. I mean, I liked it a lot. I thought it had some issues. I didn't like all the shaky cam, and I didn't like the way the action scenes were shot. It was just mind-boggling, and I couldn't tell what was going on. And, you know, it had a real Michael Bay kind of vibe to it, some of those scenes. And, you know, did you have any problems with any of that stuff, or did you just enjoy it?
Well, for me, the best part of it was the first hour where there was no action, really. It was just a description of the world and the way it operates and how people deal with it. I mean, you've got, when the film opens, it looks like Appalachia circa 1900, you know, people living in just desperate poverty in this coal mining town, you know, always on the brink of starvation and people wearing just threadbare clothing and really dilapidated housing and men coming up from the coal mines, their faces just black with coal. And we find out that there had been a war and a sort of civil war or a rebellion, and part of the peace prize was that each of the districts in this country, which is called Pan Am, has to send two representatives, two tribute sacrifices, basically, between the ages of 12 and 18 to participate in these Hunger Games every year. And we just see the really, really poor, desperate people, and then the two people get chosen, and then they get on this bullet train, this high-speed train that cruises through the countryside. And on the train, there's crystal decanters filled with various liquors, and there's just plush furniture, and it's just immaculately appointed. And then the train pulls into this capital city, which is just all monumental architecture and marble and public plazas and people in fine clothing. And I think it was really moving to me in that, you know, I've been talking about collapse now for 5 years on the Z-Realm podcast. And what this film shows is just how far you can fall and how desperate most of the people can be and still have a cohesive, functioning, stable society. And I think that's an important point that this film, I don't know if the author had a point that she wanted to make or if this is just, you know, the setting for a compelling story for her, but it was really, really gripping for me. And then when the action started, I was attached enough to the characters and I thought the storytelling was coherent that I wasn't bothered by the fact that the action scenes weren't, you know, all that expertly executed.
I think that there was a lot of buildup to those moments when the violence finally happened. And I just think that it would have been nice to be able to tell what was going on. but I think it was amazingly well acted. I think it was beautiful. I don't know if you know this, but the film was basically shot entirely in North Carolina.
Oh, it did not, but that makes sense.
Yeah, so all those forests and the wooded areas and all that stuff, and that little, the little town that they shot, all the, you know, the stuff in the District 12, all that, that actually is a little old mill town in North Carolina where they shot that. They just kind of dressed it up a little bit. And, so, I mean, obviously the state here is kind of buzzing about, you know, the part it played in that because it's the biggest thing going. And, you know, so there's been news stories on that, that area and how tourists are coming in to, you know, tour the town. And so it's been kind of fun, but, yeah, I'm so happy that a science fiction movie based on a book for children, essentially, and a movie made in my home state and all this stuff, and that it's actually good, you know, that's a popular movie, that it's not some bullshit movie and that it's not some, you know, just standard run-of-the-mill thing. I mean, this is a movie that's way more dark and way more serious than something that I would have thought would be popular. So it gives me hope for our society that has become a popular movie.
And, you know, one brilliant bit of casting in that film, you've got the boy and the girl who were chosen to go participate in the Hunger Games, and they have a sponsor who was the winner of a former Hunger Games,
right,
which means, you know, 24 people enter, one person leaves, so this is the one guy who survived. And it's Woody Harrelson.
Yes.
And he's a drunk. He's totally ruined by the experience. But, you know, just his former films, you know, Zombieland, where he's Tallahassee, and Natural Born Killers, you know, here is a person that we've seen in previous films who is just a maestro of violence. You know, so the fact that he just walks into the bar car, or, you know, into the train car, and he's got a drink in his hand and he's drunk, but it's Woody Harrelson, just says to you, yes, here is somebody that we know at a glance is capable of extreme violence. And yes, it makes sense that this guy was a former winner of the Hunger Games. So I just loved that.
Yeah, he's great. Everybody's good. I even thought, like, Lenny Kravitz and some of the people that I didn't know actually could act were good in the movie.
Oh, so. I didn't even realize that was Lenny Kravitz. He's the stylist, right?
Right, right.
Wow.
Yeah, it's really good. And, you know, it's like I said, I mean, it's nice that people kind of are getting what I think is probably a little bit better movie and feeling drawn to it instead of being drawn to whatever big splashy blockbuster, you know, that we typically get, which doesn't have anything going on beyond, you know, a bunch of action scenes.
You know, I went to see the film with my two kids,
mm-hmm,
and the oldest, he's 11, he has read the first two books.
Okay.
So this was his first experience of going into a film already having read the book. And the other one, who is 8, you know, after the film had been going for about an hour, he was really restless, he was really bored, he was putting his feet up, you know, he was lying down, making noise, fidgeting, and he says to me, how much longer? Because he was really bored. And then when the action sequence started, he was riveted. And
yeah,
at the end, I asked him how he liked it, and this is the highest praise I've ever heard from him for a movie. He said, it was kind of good.
Effusive.
Yeah.
Have either of you seen Battle Royale?
Yes.
So have you heard the joke about Hunger Games?
No.
Okay, do you know what they call the Hunger Games in France?
Battle Royale with cheese.
Exactly. And it's essentially, it's somewhat true, but I think where Hunger Games, you know, does, it kind of doesn't deserve that is in the sort of depiction of that society, that post rebellion society where these people are all being kept down by this overarching government. I mean, Battle Royale is much more just kind of a, let's stop these punk kids. And this is much more about, let's keep some control and keep everybody down except for us, you know, here at the Capitol. But it is funny, and it is, I mean, they're both movies about children killing each other. So, and that being turned into sport. So it's, you know, I think the comparison's somewhat valid, but I think The Hunger Games really deserves a little more credit than that.
Yeah. Donald Sutherland as the president was so good.
Well, it's Donald Sutherland, you know.
Yeah.
He's going to be good. But yeah, he's great, and Kay, who has read all the books, is saying that he's a great choice because of some of the things that end up happening later, which I don't know anything about.
I don't know either. I haven't read the books, although I probably will now. I was really I found the film compelling.
Yeah, it's good stuff. Everybody that I know who's read the books, you know, young and old, male and female, they all say it's great. So, so.
And hey, I listened to the most recent, but maybe not yesterday because I haven't checked, but 2 weeks ago, or maybe not last week, listened to the most recent We're Alive.
I need to get caught back up. I'm way behind.
Good. Because, yes, like I mentioned when we were interviewing, there is so much material that they could just keep going back to. It's great. It's really good. It's really well done.
I can't wait to get caught back up. But the last time I got caught up on that, I got so far behind on everything else. But I'm really I'm not going to let it go that far.
It's a seesaw.
Yeah, it's like I gotta know.
I mean, it's a seesaw, right? Yeah, no, I'm at a really comfortable pace now because I'm caught up, and so when a new episode comes out, I just pop it on the device and go out for a bike ride. It's only 20 minutes, so it's over. It's over pretty quickly. It's great.
Have we reached the end?
I think we have.
All right, so that was episode 35 of the Z-Rome podcast. We, you know, obviously we loved the 28 blank later movies. And we urge you, if you haven't seen them and you're not sick of all the spoiling we did, please check these things out. And if you haven't watched them in a while, which was the case for me, they hold up so well. They're well worth a revisit. So, you know, keep those cards and letters coming. Let us know what you think of the podcast and what you think we should talk about next. We've got a few things, I think, on our plate that we intend fully to get back to, and we're going to. You know, in the meantime, we're just kind of hitting these things as they occur to us. So if you've got some things you'd like to, you know, urge us to turn towards, please let us know. And you can reach us at mail@z-realm.com. And, you know, we do love hearing from you guys. And if you would like to leave a message over on Facebook, you know, we try to keep things updated over there. And, the community over there that we've got is really good about posting up new zombie-related stuff. And, you know, some of it's funny, some of it's interesting. You know, it's all, well, actually, it's probably all interesting. But it's all good. So, you know, join us over there, too. And, you know, just become part of the Z-Realm community. But I guess that is probably enough wrap up. So everybody, if you're out there, please keep your shotguns loaded. And when you shoot, aim for the head.